This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to the 13th edition of Screen Talk. I'm Dan Clark and I'm recording the show on a very gloomy June day, which is perfect for watching movies or TV if you don't work, which is one positive if you don't work. We have a great show lined up for you today. First of all, I'll be getting some news and reviews from the self-described cult film expert, Mr. Sam Ashurst. And then later in the show, we have actor, writer, comedian Tony Way. And we'll be chatting about his career and influences and, of course, his guilty pleasure movie. This is one that I really enjoyed because sometimes you have to watch ones that, you know, are questionable. This one was definitely... I think it probably really is a guilty pleasure in every sense. First of all, my choice of music from a film. This is from something I watched recently, a couple of days ago, in fact. Now, I love documentary features. I think we are in an era where it's hard to surprise people with films, so often fact is better than fiction. Some of my favourite films in the recent years have been documentaries, things like Man on Wire, 20 Feet from Stardom, Supermensch. I don't know if you've seen that. That's a really fun documentary about an agent in Hollywood, or a manager in Hollywood. You should check that out. Searching for Sugar Man, Anvil, The Story of Anvil, Amy, Capturing the Freeman. There's so many brilliant documentaries. This was one I watched on Sunday, which was it's called All Things Must Pass, and it was it's a documentary about Tower Records, and it's directed by Colin Hanks, son of Tom, but in his own right a very good actor. And it sort of charts the success and the downfall of Tower Records, which, I don't know, if you're my age, you'll remember, certainly in London, going to Piccadilly to the mega store, which was Tower Records. It was kind of, it was a bit of a sort of church for music, and they sort of masters there. Everyone was such a specialist in every department. But the amazing thing about this documentary is it really shows you that Tower Records was essentially two guys who owned the entire franchise. It was like an independent record store that happened to have about 40 stores around the world. And then, of course, the downloading era came upon and destroyed it. I think there's some still, it says at the end that there's some still open in Japan. Anyway, so the film is called All Things Must Pass, The Rise and Fall of Tower Records. And this song, you probably wouldn't be surprised, features in the documentary. And this is George Harrison, All Things Must Pass.
The clouds doesn't last all day.
George Harrison, All Things Must Pass. Now, with me in the studio now, we have independent film critic Sam Ashurst. He's written for Dazed, Total Film, SFX, Yahoo, Digital Spy, and MTV. I didn't even know MTV still existed. Am I sounding old there or something?
It exists, and it's amazing. Yeah, and really good online stuff, really good movie stuff. They have quite a eccentric approach to interviews. Like, right. They always do fun stuff. So, yeah,
they're great. It has to have a gimmick or a hook, or does it?
Exactly, yeah.
So have they had to embrace the online thing as well?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because there aren't as many music videos being made as there once were in the Dire Straits era of rock and roll.
It's true. I mean, there is some really good stuff out there, but their film channel is really good.
Check it out. So what film news do you bring on your travels, Sam?
Well, it's been quite an interesting week. We've got some Bond news, a couple of bits of Bond news.
There's a lot of Bond speculation and rumours and talk and backstabbing. I don't know what's going on, but there's a lot of like, this is what Bond should be, this isn't what Bond should be. It's like people get quite passionate about the Bond thing, don't they?
They get very passionate
about
the Bond
thing. And what are they
thing.
Saying this week?
Well, the latest news is that Night Manager director Suzanne Beer is apparently on the shortlist for the next one. And she's interesting because obviously Night Manager worked with Tom Hiddleston on that one. Mm-hmm. He's sort of
the front
most
runner?
People, yeah, front runner, I'd say.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure how I feel about that, to be honest.
I know how I feel, and I don't want him to do it.
Really?
Yeah. I like Tom Hiddleston. I think he's got a really nice sort of set up at the moment. Like, he's got his franchise stuff with the Marvel stuff, and in between that he's doing lots of interesting things like High Rise with Ben Wheatley recently.
The Hank Williams film, independent stuff.
Exactly. So I think he's got a really nice thing going on there.
So you're worried about him? If he does Bond, I'm worried it might go...
I think Bond might tip the balance a bit, and I think there's a lot more interesting people. My favourite would be Idris Elba. I think, you know, he's super cool, and yeah, I think he'd be amazing.
If Idris did it, do you think he would be, not that he's, you know, he's got a Cockney accent or anything, but he's definitely working class.
Yeah.
Do you think he would be asked to posh up a bit, RP up a bit?
That's really interesting.
Or do you think that if they're going to go for a slightly more untraditional Bond, that they'd embrace everything?
I'd hope they'd embrace everything, which would make it even more appealing to me. I definitely want to see a working class Bond. I know it kind of, you know, it does change the formula a little bit. But
do working class people become spies?
Yeah, you'd think so.
Yeah.
Or at least some of them pretend to be, maybe.
That makes me sound like I've never met a working class person. I know many. I come from a family of working class people, but I just don't know any spies. So that's the part that I'm not sure about.
I know loads. And
do
I,
you?
I probably shouldn't have said that.
All right, yeah. What's that red dot on your head suddenly? So, a female director for Bond, that's also quite controversial, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. It's kind of part of a movement in Hollywood at the moment. Well, there's a movement in Hollywood at the moment to push female filmmakers forward. In the last Cannes, there were a couple of sort of new production companies announced that really want to support female filmmakers. So if that's kind of part of that trend, that's kind of amazing. Like, one of the biggest franchises to be helmed by a female director would send a really strong message, I think.
Yeah. And for any sort of misogynists who have a problem with a female director, at least her name sounds like their favourite drink.
That's true.
Her surname. So, you know, it might be appealing to them. From the little that I saw of The Night Manager, it was one of those shows that I just didn't manage to see or get into at the time.
I didn't like it at all.
Okay.
So I'm kind of like...
Mixed feelings.
I'd rather Catherine Bigelow If you're going to go the female director route, like a Zero Dark Thirty version of Bond.
Be amazing,
would
wouldn't
be
it?
Incredible.
That would be but how would Catherine Bigelow doing a Zero Dark Thirty version work with Tom Hiddleston as a sort of Roger Moore-esque suave?
Yeah, no.
Do those two mix? Actually, I'd be interested in seeing that.
Yeah, no, me too.
Yeah.
And I just feel like The Night Manager was kind of a telly show trying to be Bond.
Right.
And I'd rather... like a proper film version.
It was quite it was quite sort of elegant, The Night Manager, right?
Yeah.
In the way it was shot and stuff. And maybe that's part of the appeal, because they feel like what Sam Mendes has done is brought a certain elegance back to Bond.
That's interesting.
You know, with the way it looks and feels and...
So,
I don't know.
So you say elegance, I say boring.
Well, I'm being diplomatic here.
I'm literally the opposite of James, by the way. He's very positive, I'm quite negative.
That's
so
good, I like a bit of... we need to mix it up a bit, you know. So what about the casting? There has been... hasn't there been a bit of a push for a female Bond as well? So,
well, that actually comes from an interview with Emilia Clarke.
Mm-hmm.
She basically said that she'd like to be Jane Bond.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd like Leonardo DiCaprio to be her Bond boy, which is, you know...
It's wishful thinking.
It's wishful thinking and very cool. And obviously Leo's already kind of done his Bond film in Inception, which mm-hmm. is kind of like a very weird take on a Bond film, but it's got loads of the elements in there.
Well, the skiing resort.
Exactly.
Definitely Bond. I wonder, like, if a woman did play Bond, because Bond, one of his most famous traits, let's say, is that he's a womanizer.
Yeah.
That he's a slag, let's say.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, a man can be a slag and, a Bond can be a slag, and we sort of go, oh yeah, that's Bond, that's right. What he does. But if a woman played Bond, would you have to remove the, the word for womanizing, but for menizing? Would you have to remove that element, do you think?
I think that...
Could she be, you know, luring men in? And there's no reason why not, I suppose.
Exactly. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, they should stick to exactly the same template, and mm-hmm. hopefully it'll change people's preconceptions mm-hmm. about that kind of thing, because, you know, we all like a martini.
Yeah, there you go. So that means anyone can be a Bond. Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Yeah, anyone. Yeah. I'd like to see a sort of slightly out of breath, gets up a bit late in the day Bond. You know, someone I can relate to a bit more. I always thought a good Bond would be someone who's like really old, sort of in their 70s, and maybe they're coming back for one last mission.
That would be amazing, yeah.
And he's all damaged, and he's got, you know, he lives alone because he's obviously had relationship problems. Because he was such a slag in his day, he couldn't commit. He, you know, he's just at home and he's a wreck.
I love that. Sir Ian McKellen, not that I'm saying Sir Ian's a slag. But
I think I've started something here. Let's move from the slag thing.
Okay, good.
So, you've seen a couple of movies this week?
Yes. A couple of the sort of big ones out this week. I saw Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows.
Every film seems to have a colon subtitle these days.
It does, yeah. And there's a lot of colon in... no, that's not fair. It's quite fun, in a way.
You can be as honest as you want, unless you're hoping to get a job from the... Is it Bruckheimer? Does he still produce these?
It's actually Michael Bay.
Michael Bay, that's it, sorry.
So, No. It's gotten quite a kicking. There are fun elements in it. It's got like Bebop and Rocksteady. It's got mm-hmm. Krang. It's got all those guys that you recognise from the cartoons, and they're actually done quite faithfully, unlike Transformers, say, where you can't really recognise any of the characters. There is some fun stuff in there, but overall, it is
lackluster.
Annoying.
What the thing is when a film is so clearly aimed at a certain demographic or younger audience, like kids essentially and teenagers maybe, is it fair to sort of approach a film like that with the same sort of critical mind?
Exactly. And that's why I'm kind of conflicted, because it kind of is perfect for the target audience if the target audience is very specifically a 13-year-old boy.
Okay. But it's 14, it's, no, 12, no,
exactly.
Just has to be 13.
Specifically, yeah. 13. And, yeah, young kids, very young kids. It's a 12A. So if there's anyone out there who's thinking of taking very young kids, they shouldn't, because it's actually got a couple of scary scenes. The bit like there's a mutation in it that actually looks like something from An American Werewolf in London.
You know, so in that film, in American Werewolf in London, which is one of my all-time favorite films, the bit that scared me the most as a kid was not the killings, was when he changed.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
that looks so such a traumatic experience he went through. You know, he's just lying there screaming. Ugh!
Yeah,
that was the most frightening bit, I thought.
Yeah, same for me. It's in a weird way, it's something you can relate to, even though neither of us have turned into a werewolf
or a pig or a rhino. Don't know me that well. But we have just met.
But yeah, it's there's something about body horror that, you know, like in The Fly when Jeff Goldblum like peels his fingernail off.
Yeah.
That is one of the most disturbing scenes in cinema, because you can kind of relate to it in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah. We're all going to slowly fall apart at some point.
Exactly.
And change and grow and shrink. So all in all, what would you how would you sign off on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
It's basically like a pizza. So you know,
it's fun.
It's enjoyable. It's easy, but it's probably not very good for you.
Okay, good. Okay, because I want nutritional benefits from movies I watch.
Always.
Yeah. What else have you seen this week?
The Nice Guys is out this week, which I know you're excited about.
Am I going to be disappointed?
There is no way you're going to be disappointed. The only disappointing element about it is that it kind of tanked in the States.
Really?
Yeah, which is really kind of sad for fans of original, clever... A film, full stop.
Oh
yeah, exactly.
It's so depressing.
So please, please, everyone listening to this, please go and see it. It's so good. It's so funny. It's so smart. If you're a Shane Black fan, it like ticks pretty much everything, every single box. And yeah, it's just a wonderful film. Really funny. Ryan Gosling is amazing. Russell Crowe is also amazing. Mm. And I was at the UK premiere of it, and Russell Crowe kind of emceed. he had the mic, and like he was hyping up the audience like announcing Ryan Gosling to the stage, like he was a WrestleMania announcer or something. It was brilliant.
Oh man, I wish I'd seen that.
But yeah, the film itself, amazing.
It seems to me like Shane Black is almost getting better as he gets older, you know. He's been around for years, starting with like Lethal Weapon, but it's like, I don't know, there's something. I thought Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was brilliant.
I loved
Iron Man 3. I'm just really looking forward to this. It feels like his writing is just, it's not like he's, you know, he could have easily had a good 10 years and then just slowly, you know, dwindled away. But
absolutely. And I think he's carrying on in that sort of good phase, because he's doing The Predator at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact that Nice Guys kind of bombed a bit, he's just been announced as doing Doc Savage with The Rock. So I wonder if people have seen The Predator and gone, right, yep, we want more of this, and that's why they're kind of ignoring the box office of Nice Guys.
Well, just on a side note, how is The Rock doing? So does he like literally rap one on, say, you know, Doc Savage, and then get in a car and go straight over to the set of Baywatch or whatever it is he's doing? Because the man is in so many things at the moment.
Yeah, no,
I don't know how he crams it all in.
It's kind of crazy. I think he's got some sort of time machine or some sort of time dilation device that allows him to A, be in all these films, and B, build those muscles as well. How do you do both?
I don't know. Yeah. He maybe just doesn't need sleep.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really gutted that the Nice Guys bombed, as we say. I think we use adjectives that are so severe, even though it probably in Hollywood terms that was a bomb if it didn't make, you know, X amount, but I'm sure it still made millions.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like
no one
went at all, but that's the way it sounds when people go, oh, it bombed. One person went to the cinema.
No, it definitely did okay, but if you sort of look at the quality of it, and you look at some movies that are doing a billion, and they're not especially good. It's like, stop going and seeing those ones, and then maybe go and see this one, or see them both. But
well,
please.
You know, like Transformers or the recently Superman versus Batman. It's like, and I'm not casting aspersions on either of these, but because I haven't actually seen either.
I do like Batman versus Superman.
Do you? Yeah. Is it that way around? Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Batman vs BVS, as we like to call it here. It didn't get great reviews, though, and still took a shitload of money.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind
of... That's annoying when then there's a good film that gets good reviews and is actually good and then dies. I mean...
I'm kind of all right about that because I didn't agree with, like, 98% of the reviews for BVS.
Really? I love how you just jumped on that.
But The Nice Guys is such a wonderful film. Mm-hmm. Please go and see it.
There you go. If Sam is pleading you to go and see it, I think you must. Because he actually looks quite... It looks on the edge, like something might happen if you don't go.
Oh, he's so right.
Sam, what a pleasure to have you in. I hope you will come back at some point and give us some news. Good luck with your... Who are you interviewing this weekend?
It's actually The Rock, so I'll ask him.
Yeah,
How do you do it? I'll definitely
Seriously,
ask him.
Please ask him, how do you... film so many films and keep up in shape.
I'll ask him then come back and tell you.
Great. Oh, I can't wait for that. That's a direct line to The Rock. I'm basically mates with The Rock. Okay, so the first piece of music from our special guest today is The March from A Clockwork Orange. A great choice. Had a sort of element of classical and sort of electro going on.
Yeah, it's by Walter Carlos, who in the 60s helped invent the Moog synthesizer, or Moog, as it's pronounced.
Yeah, it's actually pronounced Moog.
It's pronounced Moog. Everyone says Moog. It looks like Moog, doesn't it?
Well, you don't pronounce two O's together as O, do you?
No, exactly. But so, it's Moog, Robert Moog. She helped build that, and then she made an album called Switched on Bark, which was... similar as that, but with Bach music. And then she became Wendy Carlos later on, after all of this. But apparently, because you imagine being having a gender realignment in the late 60s, early 70s, it wasn't a common thing. So she used to get quite embarrassed by it and draw a moustache on, apparently. Wow. To do gigs and things. And
well, not to fool people.
Yeah, like, so...
What, that didn't work, did it?
Was halfway through... Well, probably not. But I mean, it must have been so hard then. Yeah. To, like, it's hard now.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so she got over all of that and now is Wendy Carlos. Yeah.
See, people think of the 70s as only a time when radio DJs molested people, but there was actually a lot of really creative stuff going on.
I think if you're in the right part of the world, it was fine.
It was fine. Anywhere other than the UK.
Yeah, exactly. If you're in New York, bits of London and bits of LA, things were fine. Everywhere else, you just got beaten up.
So we have with us Mr. Anthony. Is that your...
No, it's Tony.
It's Tony on your birth certificate.
Parents did not bother giving me a proper name. Yeah.
What do you mean, a proper name?
Well, like Anthony would be a proper name. Yeah. I was given a nickname as my real name, I think.
Tony is a strange name for a baby, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I might as well have called me
baby
sort of
Tone.
Ted or something.
Tony Way we have here, who you will recognise from... This is... I was looking at your list of credits. This is going to embarrass you, because we...
I love it.
Good. I did notice that there wasn't any blushing going on. You were just like, yep, go on. I actually can't read them all, because we haven't got time.
Well, to be honest, I forget a lot of them, so it's nice to be reminded.
Okay, well, this is just from IMDb, so there's probably stuff that's not on there, but as an actor, this isn't even including your writing credits, of which you have many as well. But on TV, you've been recently in the life of rock with Brian Pern.
Yep.
Not Going Out, Doctor Who, Derek, Game of Thrones. You were in how many episodes of that?
I was in strictly speaking, I was in three in the second season, but really I'm only in one big scene, and then so I pop up a bit, and then I had a season off. I say season because it's American.
Yeah.
And then I came back in the fourth.
I like the way you make that sound like it was your choice as well. I had a season off. I was tired.
I thought basically I wasn't coming back.
Yeah.
There was a potential to come back. And then they did get me back. And I had three very good, fun episodes to do.
Brilliant.
The beginning of season four. Yeah.
You're also in Sherlock, Life's Too Short, and film R, which is a friend of ours, Steve Oram's brilliant film.
Yes.
High Rise, Edge of Tomorrow, The Riot Club, Sightseers, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Anonymous, London Boulevard, Down Terrace, and this one I forgot because I haven't actually seen it since I went to the cinema to see it all those years ago, Ali G in Da House.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you and Martin Freeman were the friends.
Yeah, a pre-fame Martin Freeman.
Yeah,
he'd done loads, but it was pre The Office, so...
I remember before The Office, he was one of those people that was always doing stuff.
He did lots of drama and lots of plays, but he also was pretty good at comedy, too.
Yeah.
I think he did a sketch show with Mitchell and Webb.
Yeah, I remember that. I don't remember.
Bruiser. That was what it was called.
Was it called Bruiser?
There was a whole bunch of one-worded sketch shows that began with a B. I was in one called Barking and Blunder, and there was Bruiser, and all of them failed. So never, if you get a sketch show, don't call it a one-word title that begins with B.
Well, that's a good piece of advice.
But yeah, so he went away. We filmed it, and I just became friends with him.
Yeah.
And then we went away and came back to reshoot. And in the middle of that, the month in between, The Office had been on and been repeated, and he was suddenly Office famous, which
I bet
was pretty famous.
Like, funk we got him before that.
Yeah, exactly.
I bet he wouldn't be as cheap right now.
No.
He's done amazingly, isn't he?
Yeah, he's done amazingly.
He's done so good. So that's quite an amazing lineup of work. Because you're a writer as well, and I obviously know you first from years ago from doing live comedy as well. When people say to you, what do you do for a living, what do you normally answer?
Actor/writer, actor mostly these days, because the writing, it's not taking a back seat really. I still consider myself an actor and writer, but time becomes an issue.
And also writing,
it's
not
boring.
It's
hard. Ages. And acting, you just turn up and go home, you get fed, all of that stuff. So I tend to try and keep writing, but it's a carrot and stick thing.
Yeah.
So if I'm not busy, I'll start writing again.
Yeah.
Unless it's something specific, like I've written on Krakenori, and I really enjoy doing that. And that's that's one thing I like to do every year, something like that. It's different. So, it's definitely actor first these days.
Also, when you're... I mean, obviously, this applies to if you get work as an actor. The prep that goes into auditioning is like maybe you get a script a couple of days, maybe longer if you're lucky, and you learn it, you make your choices, you go in, you do it. But with pitching scripts and things, this is months and months of work that you may pitch after months, and then they go, no, we're not looking for something like that.
Yeah.
It's quite an exhausting...
It's something that I didn't haven't dealt with very well in the past. Not that I get massively depressed by it, but I feel like...
I thought you meant like you fought people.
I just get really... I feel like, oh, what a waste of my time.
Yeah.
And you know what's even worse? It's when the notes are correct. If they're wrong, you can get angry.
Yeah.
And you can go, well, you know what? They're wrong. And yeah, I'm going to fight for this. If they come back with notes, you go, actually, they're spot on. It's awful.
But although you never know when they're giving you the notes that are right in that moment, it takes you a day before you go,
yeah.
Ah, shit, mate. You never go, no, we're not doing that. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I wish I'd said that in the pitch.
Well, I get notes for things that are going to happen. And I get angry when I receive the email before I've even opened it. Because I instantly think they're wrong. Yeah. Then I look at it about an hour later, close it again, open it up a day later, and then by the end of the week I'm normally sort of on board with half of
them. Do you find notes as an actor, if you're doing something the opposite way to what a director's telling you, do you take those as personally?
Not so much with acting.
It's weird,
isn't it? I do ignore them sometimes.
Yeah. Okay.
But that I tend not to. I tend to do as I'm told, because normally they're watching you on the screen. Sometimes you do get a note, and it depends on who it is. If it's someone I don't... It rarely happens that there's someone I don't trust their opinion.
Did you ignore, say, David Fincher's notes?
No. No. But David Fincher's a very...
specific.
He's almost... We were just listening to some Kubrick film. He's almost Kubrickian.
Kubrickian? Yeah. Kubrickesque?
Kubrickesque in his... So. The amount of takes he does. It's insane. Yeah. It's
well, I was going to ask nuts. You... We're there now. I may as well ask you about this. Like, you have worked with some actual... Hollywood legends in your time, directors wise, and actually actors wise as well. But Noah Emmerich, Doug Liman, who's one of my favourite directors,
he's fantastic,
and and David Fincher. You were in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the Daniel Craig,
the American Fincher, remake,
which I loved, by the way. I thought it was brilliant.
I thought they did a great job.
And sadly, like what Sam was just saying about Nice Guys, in Hollywood terms, it bombed.
Yeah, I mean, it made its money back.
Yeah.
I think it probably made loads of money. Like you were saying, it probably made millions and millions of dollars. But I think when it doesn't make hundreds and hundreds, when things now can make $1 billion, it then just takes a little while for them to decide whether it comes back or not.
And
it's been a while now. So it still potentially could come back and be a sequel.
I've heard rumblings about...
Yeah, but I think everyone probably is way out of contract on that now. So it would be like starting again. Yeah. When it gets to that point, you think, well, they might as well start from the beginning again. But I'm ready and waiting to go back and
do it. Okay, good, good.
My character gets like a huge arc in the later books.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Oh, cool. I love that film. I thought it was really, really well done. What was it like? There are all these, you know, people... He has a reputation for doing a million takes.
Yeah, that is definitely true. I mean, it was an odd experience. I went up for it 6 times, and it was only one scene I was doing. It's just the Wayne scene I've got in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think everything I shot is in it, apart from one tiny little scene that was in a pub that you can see where it was cut. So I knew the scene inside out before I even got the yes.
Yeah.
And then I think I did a tiny bit of filming here, but the first thing I shot was in LA. So they flew me to LA, and then I waited. I talk about building up nerves. I waited in a hotel room in Hollywood for 2 weeks before they used me.
Serious?
Like, I had a costume fitting. It was like the world's biggest build-up.
Was it a nice hotel?
It was a lovely hotel, but I was going nuts because I wasn't allowed to go anywhere. I had to be within sort of driving distance of
And do you know people in LA?
No one.
Yeah,
so I think I bumped into a couple of actors I knew who were just there.
And it's not a nice place to have nothing to do. Yeah.
Especially where I was basically staying on Leicester Square, which sounds like a great thing, but it's horrible.
Yeah,
you know,
it doesn't sound like
it. No, it doesn't
it sounds
at all.
As but bad as
if you're you don't live in, if you don't know London, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
If you know London a bit, that's the worst place you could possibly be. And then they called me in, and I did a lot of reverses, so it wasn't all the... It was shooting on Rooney Mara.
Mara.
So I hadn't actually been on... I still hadn't been on screen. And they cut for, I think, a turnaround for something. So it was a little bit of a break, and David Fincher pulled me aside, and that's where I went, oh, right, this is... They've not shot on me yet.
Yeah.
I've been here for 2 weeks, they haven't really done anything. This is where I get sacked. This is where he realises he meant to get... Like, I knew a lot of people that were going up for the part, so I thought James Bartman, a friend of mine, has probably got it. Like, loads of people that went up for it. But he took me, he said, come with me. He took me to his trailer, and I thought, this is weird, so I don't really know him yet. And then he had the world's biggest Apple Mac I've ever seen.
Oh, man.
And he was cutting the trailer, which became quite iconic, that trailer.
Yeah.
In the cinema, with the shot of the snowy path. It goes up with Led Zeppelin playing over it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just said, I just want to show you what we're working towards here. And then he just played me this rough cut of a trailer. Oh, that's the best thing a director's ever done.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so it was great. And then he made me do my one line 500 times.
Oh, Jesus.
That.
Maybe that was his way of sweetening you up before he put you through hell.
You've bought in by then, so you just go with it.
That's pretty cool, though. It means he's got self-awareness about his process.
Absolutely.
And he knows, you know, what people, like his reputation in a way.
Yeah, and I think he doesn't care what people think. Definitely not. Yeah. And I think that comes from someone that was burnt on their... His first big project was Alien 3, which he lost control of.
Which I like as well, by the way.
I think it's great. Yeah. You can see where he was going with it. If he was allowed to go the whole hog, I think he would have made an amazing Alien film. Mm-hmm. He's the boss. That's it. You know, you can't blame him.
And one of the few contemporary directors that is already got that... possible acclaim of being one of the greats.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's a bad film in the bunch, really. But that's very rare.
I think Panic Room was surprisingly ordinary for him in terms of just the story and stuff.
It was quite straightforward, short story almost.
Yeah.
But still a great film.
Yeah, I loved it, yeah. So amazing. And then the difference between working with, say, Fincher and then Edge of Tomorrow with Doug Liman.
Doug Liman is like the polar opposite of that. It's completely organic. So the script,
which is amazing on a film of that budget.
I mean, mental, really, but extraordinary. Like, what happens is you get booked. So there was me and a gang who played Tom Cruise's sort of
team.
And so we were booked for 6 months straight. That's it. We were in every day, whatever happened.
Mm-hmm.
A month of which was training, because we had to wear these robot suits, which weighed 10 stone.
Jesus.
So it was extraordinary. Straight away, you're knackered every day and in pain. But the script never stayed the same. It was fluid, the script.
Mm-hmm.
There were moments where I found myself giving suggestions of what I should say, and you're surrounded by 300 crew members, and you think, this is probably costing about $5 million. Just while Doug Liman listens to what I've got to say on the situation.
Oh,
why is this? Yeah, it's bizarre.
So what, he was up for
absolutely.
Really?
He'd come over to you and say, what would you say?
Yeah.
And I'd go, and there'd be 300 people looking. You'd go, well, I'd probably, you know, say, I don't want to do the push-ups or something like that. And he'd go, how does that sound? Then you'd sort of do it for him. And he'd go, no. But maybe something like that.
Yeah.
And he'd go around everyone. And it was great. I mean, that comes from having a lot of money and time, and Tom Cruise wanted to do it that way.
And also, I always find Doug Liman an interesting director in that, you know, he did Swingers, which is one of my all-time favourite comedies, and then somehow has worked his way up into doing these huge...
Yeah, it's odd.
...multi-million dollar, action films.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're all clever. They've all got
I think he would consider himself still an indie filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I think he would consider... I think the turning point must be Bourne, the Bourne films.
Yeah, so which is still, I have to say, my favourite Bourne.
It's extraordinary.
The first one. I love the Greengrass ones, but it's still my favourite.
Yeah, you need it as well to get to the Greengrass ones. And I think he would consider that an indie film.
Yeah.
But just with really good fighting in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And good action, and it's a thriller, isn't it? I think it became huge because so many people loved it.
Yeah.
And I think that instantly puts you into a different...
Definitely.
League as a director.
Yeah. I mean, how amazing to work with all these brilliant directors. Like and you're still young, so you're going to get to work with all the best. But judging by your trajectory, you know, I have to ask how it was working with Mr. Thomas Cruise Mapper first.
It was great. I mean, it's like a weird, an enjoyable dream that doesn't sort of end. Because it was work still. We were still working.
Yeah, yeah.
But your work, there's Tom Cruise every day.
Yeah.
You go in. So you sort of find yourself becoming complacent. That sort of becomes the everyday. But then every now and again you go, that is Tom Cruise.
And you it was are really, Tom Cruise, right?
But this is really weird. Like when I first met him, he very cleverly, because he can't have it. I mean, I'm sure he likes people knowing who he is.
Yeah, yeah.
But he can't work that way with everyone. Look, like you can't act with people if they're looking at you like you're Tom Cruise all of the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unless he's playing, you know, I don't know, like the Top Gun character where everyone is in awe of him.
Yeah.
You're not in this film, we're all supposed to think he's a dick.
Yeah. Which is one of the great things about that film.
It's quite rare.
And
he dies in it and stuff like that. So they were building and building up. We were training for the first week. And they were building up to us meeting him properly. We'd sort of seen him in passing and at reads and things like that. But he just, instead of waiting for this build-up, he just came to where our we were based.
Yeah.
Just walked on the corridor and said hello to everyone. So it instantly knocked any of the build-up to it out of us. And I spent that 20 minutes just looking at his face, really looking at his face, thinking, I have to get used to this.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I'm just going to get sacked. I won't be able to talk.
Yeah, yeah.
And that really helped. I just looked at him, and he half knew one of the other members of cast, so I just looked at him talking to someone. And if he'd looked at me at that point, I think he would have sacked me as well. But so I got over it, basically.
Yeah.
But it was nuts. Like, there's my biggest name-dropping story ever.
Yeah.
This is what it was like every day. Was I had to walk away from talking to Bill Paxton so that Tom Cruise could introduce me to Matt Damon.
Wow.
It's sort of like weird. That sort of stuff happened every day on that job.
Oh, my God.
And then the minute it finished, it instantly stopped happening, which you have to get used to.
And you were back down the pub in East London. I remember there was this like rumour going round that you're not allowed to stare Tom Cruise directly in the eye.
Yeah.
And it became this thing like he doesn't like people looking at him. All I kept thinking was, I bet what's happened, right, is one day he was doing a scene that had lots of extras, essays, you know, and someone was just like mouth open, gawping at him. Yeah, and he's like, you know, this is like, I'm meant to be doing this scene. It's a bit weird if you... So an assistant director or a production runner or someone has gone up to the SA and gone, look, do you mind not just staring at Tom like that all the time? That person went home and gone, we're not allowed to stare at Tom Cruise. And then that turns into some massive, like, he doesn't have eye contact.
I think you've hit the nail on the head with that. Yeah, because it's not...
And you were one of them.
Well, yeah, on day one. I wasn't allowed to. The thing is, that is such the opposite, because he's got a really... He does fix your gaze quite disturbingly. He loves to...
Engage.
I mean, he's probably sick of talking about himself. So the thing that you really take home from meeting him and working with him is how much he asks about you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, half the questions, if I asked him, he probably wouldn't want to answer them anyway, because it's private.
Yeah.
But also, he talks about himself all of the time. It's constant.
Yeah.
So he genuinely, and he asks a lot about your life, and... Well, that's quite boring.
I know. Everyone
but he seemed interested.
Everyone that works with him says he's a really super nice guy, and he seems like he has a great work ethic. I have to say, I would love to work with him. I am a fan of his work, right? I think he's sort of underrated in a weird kind of way. But I have to say, I would work with him tomorrow, but I think there would be this voice in my head all the time going, I dare you to say, so what's all this Scientology about?
Well, yeah, I mean, I must admit, like, I did not bring any of that up.
Yeah.
I felt, if he brought it up, I suppose I would have had to talk to him about it.
But I would love
it didn't come up.
Yeah, I would love to talk about it just in a sort of honest grown-up conversation, just to sort of see what his...
Yeah, I'm sure he would have. I'm sure he's happy to talk about it. Weirdly, I wasn't going to get into it.
I think he's got people saying, "Don't talk to people about it too much."
Maybe he seems to be his own man.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't. The thing that really struck me was there was no entourage. It was him. I mean, they say there's no entourage, but there was no one following him around.
Yeah.
So he has his people.
Not that you know of.
We had his security guard, Mario.
Yeah.
That's it. Just one guy. Basically, just goes with him everywhere. Because you'd need that if you were as famous as him. And he has chefs and trainers, but they're not following him.
Mm-hmm.
They're where they should be, in the gym and in the... So I was actually surprised at how few people followed him around.
Mm.
I don't know. It didn't come up.
They may all work for the C Corp, which is a whole
sure
other thing.
They do.
Another director you work with who is now fast becoming a director who belongs in those in a list with those other people is Ben Wheatley, and you were there. You were there from the beginning, Down Terrace.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, was his first feature, right?
Yes, I think he'd worked on some film stuff long before.
Mm-hmm.
He was a film school student.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew him as a comedy... I mean, you'd probably now call them... It's so unromantic, comedy content provider. At the time, no one was doing stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
He was making little videos, little funny things. Mm. And I think that turned into little ads and little viral adverts.
And he went onto the Wrong Door, was it?
Wrong Door with that, because his stuff on... Well, I knew him as an editor as well. He edited some and wrote on some comedy shows that I had worked on. And then, so the two things combined. The big thing about his online stuff was he used extraordinary-looking CGI on tiny little internet videos, which is very rare. Everyone does it now.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the time, that was impossible.
Yeah.
And I think the two combined and made Wrong Door. And I think he worked on like Time Trumpet and
yeah, yeah.
He edited and did special effects for
the Armando Iannucci thing.
Yes, yeah. So he did. There's an amazing sketch about Tesco's invading Europe.
Yeah.
And the Tesco's shops are all like robots. It's like Transformers. Yeah. That's all him. That's he basically.
So in a way, it's weird that that was what he was known for, and then his first feature was the polar opposite to that. No CGI, all very intimate, small, all shot in one house over a few days, right?
It was shot a week.
Yeah.
But no professional actors were engaged, including myself, were used for more than 2 days, because we were all doing it for nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So he, Dad Robin Hill, who also co-wrote it and is an editor, the family who actually did live in that house, or Robin grew up in that house, they were there for the full 7 to 9 days.
Yeah.
Myself, Gareth Tunley, Julia Deakin, people like that, Dave Scharl, and Michael Smiley, we came in for a couple of days and then we'd go.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like a laugh. The script was good. I had no idea how good it was going to turn out to be. On the second day of filming, I realised it was going to be something different.
Yeah.
I still had no idea it was going to be the start of Ben's stellar career.
Amazing, yeah.
I mean, there's an original version of the script that, you say it's very different. I've heard of a original version of the script that had a massive CGI worm in the back garden that Ben had written.
Okay.
Like years before, where they fed
I did feel like it was missing something.
That,
yeah.
Yeah. They fed, like, he needed.
And then, so what's it like working with him now that he's doing a big budget stuff like High Rise?
It's very similar. You know, he's very down to earth.
Yeah.
It's obviously ridiculous, the cast he's got. And I think Free Fire is out soon. Mm-hmm. So he makes films in his sleep. He's making loads, like he's desperate to catch up.
He's like the Rock of directors.
Yeah, exactly. But and also, he will be shooting with the Rock next. Yeah. Like, he's got insane cast in these films now.
Yeah.
Like Hiddleston, and he's got Carl Urban in the next one. And,
oh, amazing.
But it's nice that he keeps people like me.
Yeah, it's like keeping the troupe together.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But also not using us when we're not, there's no fit for us, which is good.
Yeah.
He doesn't force us into it. If there's not a part for you, he won't put you in it.
Yeah,
bastard.
Well, this leads us on to, there's no segue whatsoever, but we are going to discuss your guilty pleasure, Tony. Now, this is actually, like I said at the beginning, a little bit more enjoyable than some of the guilty pleasures, but definitely naff on many levels. Yeah, we've got a little clip, and let's see if people can guess what this film is, judging by the clip.
Okay, pussyface, it's your move.
Shit happens.
The Great Gatsby.
It's actually Down Terrace. You've picked your own film that you're in as a guilty pleasure. Can you imagine? Why don't you tell everyone what that is from?
Right, it's Predator 2.
Yeah.
Which, the main reason I've chosen, there's two main reasons I've chosen this.
Mm-hmm.
One is it meant that you'd have to now watch Predator 2. Once I suggested
it. What have I done to you?
Also, I had an argument, which I genuinely believed at the time, that this film was better than the original Predator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just said it and then wouldn't back down.
Okay.
So it was an ongoing argument. It wasn't. I think I was a bit young for that. Maybe I was sixth form of time. So 18, 17, 18.
And you're
probably
scared to be wrong, so you just keep...
Absolutely.
Yeah, soldiering on with your opinion.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was with my friend Glyn, who was probably quite rightly... said, no, it's not better. It's the sort of thing we used to argue about in our weird doing our film A-levels.
Yeah.
But I genuinely did love it, and I did think it was better for about 10 minutes, and they realised I was wrong, but never backed down. But it's an extraordinary film. I mean, you just heard that. He called him Pussyface. I mean, you don't hear that sort of
dialogue. It's got all those classic lines like, you know, I put my ass on the line for you and I got the DA right up my ass. They're always obsessed with their ass, aren't they? Yeah.
And things go right up it.
They always have things up it. But the weird thing, when I started watching it, I was watching it yesterday, and immediately I thought, is this the set of Falling Down? You know, the Michael Douglas film?
Yeah.
It looks like, have you Wrapped guy's great. Do you mind if we just come on and take over?
Similar time, so it would make sense.
And there was this. There's a lot of LA Riot sort of subtext going on.
The thing about Predator. This is one of my arguments. I don't actually believe in it anymore. But Predator 2 exists. If you take the Predator out of it, it exists as a really good gang war film.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Predator 1, no Predator. They just, they kill and they go home. So also, it's got. We've talked about
men in the jungle.
It'd just be loads of men in the jungle after they've done their job.
With shots of their biceps as they shake hands. Yeah, the other weird thing about Predator 2, which I found, which surprised me, is it starts, this film was made in 1990, and it says Los Angeles, 1997. Ooh. Hey, like that is far in the future. But also, they're predicting that LA is going to turn into this absolutely crime-ridden city, which maybe there was more crime back then.
I think that the early 90s, LA thought that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Just after King.
Yeah, I don't think the Rodney King thing, was that like 91 or 92?
It was just before, I'm only going by the O.J. Simpson drama. I think it might have been just before. But there was stuff happening.
Yeah.
And actually, weirdly, I think it all went the other way in LA. I think that it got nicer. I don't know LA so well.
Sort of maybe in some respects, homogenised or something. I don't know.
Yeah, they failed to predict the rise of Britpop.
Yeah.
Didn't spot that, did they?
No, they didn't. That's
it should have been loads of Blur and Oasis in 97.
That's true. But did Britpop reach the United States?
No, I doubt it.
But did
They were still getting over Nirvana in America then, I think.
Was it... you should have had, like, in Predator 2, as the camera passed, there was a shot of an art house cinema with Trainspotting playing or something like that. Do you genuinely love it, or do you think it's shit, but you love it?
I haven't seen it for a while, but if it's on... I watch it. I don't go out of my way to. I saw it. I genuinely saw it. I was also. Do you remember the press obsession with the idea of Yardies, which didn't really exist? It's a thing that since is now, I think, considered a bit racist. That there's these marauding gangs of Jamaicans all doing crack and chopping people's heads off. But that quite an exotic thing around that time. And I remember...
Is it Puerto Ricans in...
And Puerto Ricans. Yeah. It's Puerto Ricans versus Jamaicans. Yeah. I don't think that ever... That's not a battle that ever happened. But it does in this weird film. But also, if you ever liked any drum and bass, which I did a little bit around that time, I was probably just the right
age. They didn't predict that either.
No, they did. But they sampled every other Jamaican character's line into about 20 different
drum bases. From
Predator 2,
Wow.
So especially, is he called Big Willy? All of his lines, this is Dreadman and all of that weird made-up voodoo stuff. Yeah, that sort of kept the drum and bass scene going for about 10 years.
Something that also, like, really... I'd sort of forgotten about that happens in these films is, like... you have one sort of bigger name and then lots of lesser known sort of almost B-movie actors. This was in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s. They could only afford one big A-lister and then all the rest were people. And they got Danny Glover. Who, I love as an actor, by the way. I think he's amazing, but I'm not sure he was ever A-lister. So they always felt like Predator 2 with Danny Glover. Oh, it's gone down a little bit,
I think Predator became the star in Predator 2.
Yeah.
And then, which, I mean, it's...
propelled like a million sequels, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's got Bill Paxton in it doing one of his famous turns. He does a really good arse. He's done a load of them.
He was so good.
He's brilliant.
He was like, when that film came out, it just had like, it had all those sorts of actors where you know them only by the one film that they like. So it came on, I was like, oh yeah, look, it's the Lethal Weapon boss.
Oh, it is, yes.
Is one of his. Yeah. And there's the bad guy from The Goonies. Yeah. And then there's the weird science older brother. And then the girl in it is the girl from Running Man. It was all those sorts of. Except for Bill Paxton, who's since become like an actor.
Yeah, and Bill Paxton has done a very similar turn to that in Aliens and various, like, sort of.
He was that guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, a knob, basically.
He's turned it around, though. I think Twister was the big turning point. Yeah, exactly. Big turning point, you like that? I think it's definitely a guilty pleasure in the truest sense of the world, in that it's not a great film, but it is really pleasurable.
I always end up watching it. Really? If it's on, even if it's halfway through on ITV7, I'll go, go on then.
Yeah,
I'll sit and watch it.
I'll treat myself. There's some great lines in it. And if you want a Predator film with some social commentary, it's definitely the Predator for you.
Social commentary on a commentary on a social situation that never existed.
That's what I'm up for. Well, thanks very much, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
You're very welcome.
An absolute pleasure. I could talk more. Like, we didn't even talk about your live comedy stuff, but
I mean, that's a very short conversation.
let's not do it. Would you ever do live comedy again?
I do it occasionally, but on other people's things. Like, I've done Club Fantastico, which is Steve Oram and Tom Meaton's thing. But it's like they give me something to do. Yeah. I haven't really got an act anymore as such. Not that I really ever had one. No. But I happily will do.
And
some
you still
stuff.
Work with, because obviously the first time I ever met you was way back when you were doing Stay Alive Peppy.
Yes.
And do you still work with Steve and Reese?
I do. Yeah. I mean, they're still good friends. We never split up as such. But to be honest, we were never. It was a name of a group that didn't. It wasn't really a live group.
Yeah.
We were into making videos and stuff. So we did do live stuff, and it was. You know, we had a couple of memorable gigs.
Yeah.
We got banned from the Canal Cafe.
I remember. I think I was there the night that happened.
you were really good. I remember your group. You were brilliant.
Oh, thank
I seem
you.
To remember Sorry. Very clearly. It ties in with the show. You used to dance. Did you used to dance to the film? Would have been 96 theme tune as part of one of your things.
Well, you mean like the film show that Barry Norman used to do?
It would have been film 95.
No, but we
then.
Did do a lot of silly dances.
I'm sure you danced to that.
Maybe we did. Maybe. We did use a lot of stuff. So your second choice of song, this is a great song. And it also, it reminded me of, you know, Joel Morris's band, Candidate.
Yes, they
did an album that was inspired by the film The Wicker Man.
I mean, Joel Morris in general is just inspired by The Wicker Man.
Yeah. But I listened to it this morning because I forgot about that album and I was like, this is great. Yeah. It's a really good album.
Yeah.
But this is from The Wicker Man and it's Corn Rigs by Paul Giovanni, right?
Yes, yeah.
And why did you pick this?
It's another film that I can watch at any given moment. And I just listened to this whole soundtrack recently. I was, me and my girlfriend were away for a weekend over the May Day bank holiday in beautiful sunshine in Norfolk. And we just drove around listening to it. It's the perfect
Which is weird
soundtrack.
In a way. It's like
it is.
This beautiful music, but the film's so
you
fucked up.
And it's this, especially this song.
Yeah.
You have no idea what, you're being let in. When you first see this film, you have no idea what's coming because it's a lovely plane ride and it's a lovely there is a cut of this.
No spoilers, please.
But you know there are several cuts of this film.
Right.
There is the most ultimate, they call it the ultimate cut.
Yeah.
It's the worst version because it's really good later on, but at the beginning you see him on the mainland being given the job he has to do.
Yeah.
So you don't start on him flying a plane with this lovely music over it.
Mm-hmm.
You start on him going, there's someone's been gone missing.
Okay.
Which is really weird. And I think that was probably something they didn't need to put back in. But
it sort of already tells you that it's going to get a bit
exactly.
weird.
You know
it?
He's going there for a bad thing, not for a good thing. Or you know.
Just on the on a quick side note on the director's cuts and things, I can never work out from people's opinions which is the Blade Runner to watch because there's so many cuts. Is there a general consensus of which is the one to watch?
Yeah, it's the one without the commentary. Is
without
the,
his narration.
Yeah, yeah. But I know that one so well. I know them all so well. I find it genuinely hard to tell the difference.
Yeah.
I don't
my
know.
Girlfriend
I've got a
to
box
see
with
it.
About six.
I don't know which one to show her. Anyway, so this is from... I was about to say Lord of the Rings, that's weird. This is from The Wicker Man, which is the inferior version of the Nicolas Cage.
Which is the best
masterpiece.
Film ever.
Yeah.
I love that film.
This is Corn Rings. Thank you very much, Tony.
Cheers.
It was upon a Lammas night when corn rigs are bonny. Beneath the moon's unclouded light, I held a while to Annie. Time went by with careless heed, till tween the late and early. With small persuasion she agreed to see me through the barley. rigs and corn rigs are bonny. I'll not forget that happy night among the rigs with Annie. Was all my own. I loved her most sincerely. I kissed her o'er and o'er again among the rigs of barley. Corn rigs and barley rigs, and corn rigs are bonny.